Hello there. So you're about to listen to a conversation that I recorded with the philosopher Regina Rini about the epistemic consequences of deepfakes, particularly the political uses of deepfakes. So this is a really, I think, interesting and timely discussion in light of some of the recent attempts to legislate for the use of deepfakes in political discourse, and of course some of the recent elections and upcoming elections that are taking place around the world. Before we get into that discussion, just a couple of quick notes at the outset. Again, I'd like to stress that I have a book available for purchase, Automation and Utopia, which came out at the end of September this year. It's probably a bit late to get it in time for Christmas, but you can still buy it as a present for the new year. This is probably the last time I'll mention it on the podcast, and I apologize if you're sick of me talking about it. I have a talk upcoming in London on the 11th of January with the London Futurist Group in Birkbeck College in London. If you're around London on those dates, it'd be great if you could come out and attend that talk. And finally, just in relation to this podcast, if you like it, please rate it and recommend it online or review it on iTunes. iTunes ratings really help, I think, with the promotion and public promulgation of this podcast. Although, of course, iTunes no longer exists. It's Apple Podcasts now, or whatever the replacement is. Okay, so without any further ado, let me just now hand over to the conversation that I had with Regina Rini.
Okay, so my guest today is Dr. Regina Rini. Dr. Rini currently teaches in the philosophy department at York University, Toronto, where she holds the Canada Research Chair in Philosophy of Moral and Social Cognition. She has a PhD from NYU, and before coming to York in 2017, was an assistant professor and faculty fellow at the NYU Center for Bioethics, a postdoctoral research fellow in philosophy at Oxford University, and a junior research fellow at Jesus College, Oxford. Her research focuses predominantly on moral agency, moral disagreement, the psychology of moral judgment, partisanship in political epistemology, and the moral status of artificial intelligence. Welcome to the show, Regina.
Thanks very much. It's great to be here.
Okay, so we're going to talk today about, I guess, the last two of your philosophical interests, looking at the epistemological implications of deepfake technology. Now, I'm sure many listeners know roughly what deepfakes are, but for those who don't, they are a way in which you can use machine learning to construct synthetic video, and I'm guessing now audio materials as well. I think I've heard of research in that field.
Yes.
So, the advent of this technology has kicked off something of a panic in certain circles. I just noted that the state of California, I think at the start of October of this year, 2019, has passed legislation that bans the use of deepfakes in the lead up to elections. And there are other states and countries that have banned the use of deepfakes to create revenge porn. So in our conversation, we'll try to examine some of the important philosophical questions raised by this technology, focusing largely on a paper that you wrote recently entitled Deepfakes and the Epistemic Backstop. So maybe we could just start out by explaining in a bit more detail what deepfakes are and how they work.
Sure. So deepfakes are a somewhat sophisticated form of video and audio fabrication, and they use a form of machine learning that, one way to think about it is, it basically uses predictive technology to build a kind of model of a person's face or their voice. And what it allows the machine to do is to create a facsimile of what that face or voice would look like or sound like if it did something different than what it already did. So one way to think about that is a kind of digital mask. We can make a mask imprint of your face and put it on somebody else's face in a video so that your face appears to do whatever their face is doing. Or in audio, we can make a kind of a copy of your vocal signature so we can make it sound as if you are saying words other than what you're actually saying.
Yeah, that's a good explanation, I think. And correct me if I'm wrong, I think like one of the key points here is that a deepfake is not like an edited version of a pre-existing audio file. It's something that's constructed de novo from this kind of digital mask or digital model of your image or your voice. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. It basically takes in a very large data set of existing recordings. It needs that as a kind of fuel. But then once it's got all of that existing recording, it uses that to generate new things.
Yeah, okay. So again, if you think about classic like audio clips that have been edited to make it sound as though somebody's saying something that they're not saying, that's usually due to careful editing of a pre-existing audio as opposed to the synthetic construction of a new audio file, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. So, I mean, how convincing are deepfake images or audio files? I mean, I remember a couple of years ago when these Obama deepfake videos started circulating, and you know, I thought they were interesting, but they weren't hugely convincing. Pretty obvious that they were fake in some sense.
Yeah, so it really depends what you're looking at. Some deepfakes, to my eye, are surprisingly convincing. Usually those are the ones that have been done by some sort of academic department or Hollywood studio or government agency. They're done by somebody with a lot of money and time. The ones that are done live on the internet by random people tend to be not very convincing. You can kind of, especially in like deepfakes of people's faces, you can often see some strange blurring around the jawline, around the hairline, things that don't look natural. So you can sometimes tell. The tricky thing is that with low quality video resolution, if you're watching a YouTube video that was clearly not filmed in high definition, even unaltered videos can look blurry in that way. So it's not always a dead giveaway if you're looking at low quality video. But it is true that at least so far, the technology is not very reliably perfect.
Right. So it's kind of a function of, well, partly like how carefully the deepfake video was constructed, but also I guess partly, and this is generally speaking true when we interpret information, you know, how much attention we're paying to it or what our background yes. expectations are when it comes
Absolutely.
To that information.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the tricky thing is that the technology does seem to be improving bit by bit. It's been around for about 5 years. It's been known publicly for about 2 years. And it does seem to be getting better every year. The big thing that has changed in the last couple of years, which I think is especially scary, is real-time deepfakes. So traditionally, a deepfake was basically something generated on the side. It was use existing data sets, build up a video, post that. But now what's becoming possible, especially in academic departments, is in real time, suppose on Skype, you're watching a person, you're talking to them, and then in real time, another person's face or possibly voice can be superimposed over them. So it's happening in moment to moment. So we can imagine, as far as I know, this hasn't happened yet with video, although apparently it has happened with audio in some cases. It's alleged to have happened in some legal cases. Phone calls are faked between real people in real time by using this kind of technology to generate novel sounds.
I'm just actually, now that you mention it, I'm kind of curious as to what is the academic justification for doing this? Because we're going to talk about a bunch of problems that arise from the creation of these technologies, but the researchers who create it, why do they do it? Just because it's there, or is there some...
Yeah, that's part of it. I mean, part of it is just that the underlying technology is a general form of machine learning technology. Many of it uses a form of technology called adversarial learning, where basically two different machine learning algorithms work against each other, and they're competing to produce better forms of whatever it is they're doing. And whatever it is they're doing doesn't have to be deepfakes. It could be generating text. It could be improving design efficiency of an industrial process, et cetera. So the underlying mathematics and the problem solving, it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with tricking people into believing images. It's just a challenge of, can you do this really hard thing? And it should be clear that this is actually a pretty hard thing. Creating convincing audio and video is not simple. And so if you can do it, that's a benchmark for impressive mathematics, relatively impressive deep learning. And so people want to do it for that reason. There's also a commercial incentive for some applications. I think the most famous are from Hollywood studios. They don't use the same technology. They use more traditional computer-generated imaging, and it's much more expensive. But basically, what's very common now is for big Hollywood studios to create a full face map of big stars so that if in the middle of filming something happens to that star, they can still go on and create the rest of the film by creating what's going to be like a deep fake of that person's face doing the rest of the scenes. A very famous example of this is Carrie Fisher in the current Star Wars films. She sadly died between filming of, I think, the first and second, and they've been able since then to recreate some scenes, and I think the speculation is in the final film this will continue. Anyway, I don't know the whole story here, but that's done with really expensive Hollywood technology. It's different than the deepfake stuff you find on the internet. The promise of deepfake, however, is if the technology got really good, then it could do that for Hollywood studios much, much, much more cheaply and quickly, and that's a big commercial incentive for somebody to try to make the technology perfect in that way.
That's interesting. I can imagine that the Actors Guild isn't going to be too happy with this because it Well, it could potentially undermine the value or utility of actors, in a sense.
No, it's totally true, and there's going to have to be legal disputes settled about who owns the right to your image. Could you sell your image and your sort of your body shape and your voice in perpetuity so that a Hollywood studio can then do anything it wants with you on the screen for the rest of history? I don't know how that's going to get settled, but we're approaching a point where that becomes a realistic question.
Yeah, I mean, there are image rights in some U.S. states, as far as I recall. I actually don't know what kind of, I guess it's a form of intellectual property, or not exactly intellectual property, but aesthetic property in yourself, which yeah. Some states allow you to claim an ongoing legal interest or entitlement to. I don't know how long that is, but yeah.
Although the one difference is that usually applies to existing imagery, not to novelly generated audio and video recordings that appear to be actual recordings and that could be reproduced endlessly after your death for years and years and years. I can imagine legal challenges saying that the existing form of law does not cover that sort of thing.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And if the existing law is not adequately formulated to cover this possibility, no doubt lawyers will argue that it's not covered. So yeah, as
exactly.
you pointed out, it's an issue that needs to be addressed. I mean, the other question I wanted to ask initially here, just as kind of setup, was about the
sure.
the different current uses of deepfakes. So you've mentioned one here in terms of Hollywood studios. I guess, mm-hmm. you know, as with many things on the internet, deepfakes came to most people's attention as a way of constructing these synthetic pornography videos. I think I read some study that suggested that, like, that's still the majority use case. It's something like 90% or 95% of deepfakes
right.
are porn-based.
That's right. Yeah, so a data security firm did a survey of this and found that 96% of extant deepfakes on the web are porn-related, which shouldn't be that surprising. Other people have found that somewhere between 12 and 30% of all web traffic is pornography in some way. That's very hard to quantify, but porn is a very big thing on the internet. And for deepfakes, it is definitely where the current discussion came from. So it came to public attention about 2 years ago in late 2017. The journalist Samantha Cole wrote a series of articles about deepfakes, and they came out of a Reddit forum. And there, the whole point was to create fake pornography where people could post requests for others to create fake versions of porn where they took their favorite actress's face and imposed it over an existing pornographic film of someone else. And this was a very popular thing late in 2017 on Reddit. The forum was eventually banned by Reddit. Several other sites, including Pornhub, banned deepfake pornography, but it's still obviously out there on the internet in various darker corners of the net. And more importantly, what came out of the Reddit forum was an app that was made free and available for anyone to download. It's not the highest level of technology, but it produces deepfakes and it's free. And all you need is to download the app and to have a certain number of existing videos and images of the person you want to deepfake, and you can do it on your home computer. So that came out of that original use of pornography. And it is still statistically true that the vast majority of this stuff is porn-related. But again, I kind of want to flag that percentage as reflecting the fact that porn is just so present in everything on the web.
Yeah, and I think some of the uses in porn are ethically interesting and problematic, but I think I want to talk a bit more about the political uses, because that's, I think, kind of yep. what your article is mainly about,
yes.
right?
Yeah, I think that's a good distinction to draw. I also just want to comment on that, because I don't want to downplay the ethical danger. There's a serious, serious problem with involuntary pornography being used for harassment and for revenge. And so the ethical issues related to deepfakes, I think, are primarily around the porn application. But I think you're right to distinguish that for the epistemic question, which I think is our focus today. The political dimension is the more pressing one.
Yeah, no, I endorse what you said. I just, a couple of weeks ago, I wrote an article about the need to cover deepfakes in revenge porn legislation in Ireland, because mm-hmm. I was questioning whether the existing legal framework actually covered it. But yeah, let's focus on the political uses for the remainder of this conversation.
Sure.
And I mean, actually, I think there was a couple of weeks ago a video that was released as part of the kind of UK election that's ongoing at the moment, of the two leaders of the main parties appearing to endorse each other, and I believe that was a deepfake video. Are there any other worrisome political uses of this technology?
So far, there hasn't been a well-documented case of a definitive deepfake used in a political application that has been widely believed and were subsequently debunked, caught in some way. One worrisome possibility is that there has been a deepfake deployed that no one has caught yet, but I don't know. That's speculative. The concern for the moment is more anticipating what could happen, which is the way I think about it. A deepfake gets out there in a political context, perhaps in the UK election, perhaps in the US election next year, in some active political dispute. And it is believed by some and not believed by others. And then someone introduces the thought that it might be a deepfake, but no one is quite sure. And from this, there is a huge public dispute over whether or not we can still trust video and audio. And so my worry is less that people do end up believing it than that the big public dispute over whether or not it can be trusted leads to all kinds of new forms of skepticism.
Yeah, so this is kind of a poisoning of the whale effect here because
exactly.
of this. Right. Let's go into this a bit more in a bit more detail, kind of theoretically, because you set out this nice theoretical framework for thinking about this political impact of deepfakes or social epistemological mm-hmm. impact of deepfakes, let's say. So I mentioned the title of your paper earlier on, which is Deepfakes and the Epistemic Backstop. So you're looking at how deepfakes undermine the epistemic backstop that we rely on currently in society. Could you explain at first, what do you mean by that concept of the epistemic backstop?
Sure. So what I'm building on is a lot of existing work in social epistemology. That is the branch of philosophy having to do with knowledge and justified belief. And there's a lot of work on testimony, which for philosophers doesn't mean like legal testimony in a court of law. It just means any transmission of information between people where my justification for coming to believe something is on your say-so, on your telling me something and me trusting you that you know what you're talking about and you're not trying to trick me. And it's really important to remember that the vast majority of what almost all of us know relies on testimony to some extent. Unless you've gone out there and recreated every historic science experiment that's ever been done, then most of your knowledge of science comes from relying on the testimony of those who say they've done the experiments or those who say they've seen them do it, et cetera, et cetera. Similarly for history, similarly for news, et cetera, et cetera. Most of what I know about the world relies upon testimony being mostly reliable. Most of the time, people are mostly telling the truth. And that's generally been true for the most part throughout history. And so part of the thought I have is that in the last century or so, since the development of audio and video recording technology, the reliability of testimony has actually become stronger and actually become reliant to some extent on the technology. So this is the concept of the epistemic backstop. The thought is this: people have a greater incentive to be honest and to only talk about things they actually know about because there's the always present possibility that there's an audio or video recording that could contradict them if they speak falsely. So there could be a recording of them saying otherwise in the past, or there could be a recording of the thing they're testifying about showing that they've misremembered it or lied about it. So the knowledge we have that there could be recordings out there, in some cases there definitely are recordings out there, that govern other people's will allow other people to learn the truth independently of our testimony, gives us an incentive to be more honest in our testimony.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things to what you said that I just want to underline, which I think are important. One is that there is this tremendous reliance on testimony, either what people say to us happened to them or happened to other people, or written testimony describing events that have happened historically, and that's how we form most of our beliefs. So I think that's an important point because, and this is a inherent in that concept of the epistemic backstop, we all know, don't we, that like testimony is unreliable in many cases, or I don't know if many cases is correct, but certainly it's not a perfect window onto the world. We know that people lie or deceive or they misremember events, right? So
that's right. And I think that's an important point to keep in mind. We often think about lying, but just as much of a danger to testimony is incompetence. So if I just want to look like I'm smart and I start telling you about something that I actually don't know anything about, I'm not lying per se because I don't know what I'm saying to be false, but I also don't know it to be true. So I'm being irresponsible. And so part of testimony is that people are not only being sincere, but they're also being competent. They warn you if they don't know something about a topic rather than just start opining on it without actually knowing what they're talking about. And so that's the constant danger of testimony, generally speaking, it needs to be reliable. And generally, we can rely upon it. Otherwise, this wouldn't work. We wouldn't have all the knowledge of the world we happen to have. But in any particular case, there is always the risk that the person you are talking to is lying to you or is incompetent and isn't being careful to talk about only what they know about. And so that's the risk. In any individual case of testimony, are you justified in believing this person? Well, it depends on lots of facts about their knowledge and their track record and things like that. But generally speaking, we tend to take it as a default reliability. And what I've been claiming here, the new move I'm making in this paper, is to suggest that in the last few generations, we've really come to rely on the assumption that audio and video recordings provide this kind of backstop. They make it more reasonable to trust strangers, because strangers, everybody is aware that it's possible they'll be checked by this independent recording function.
Right. I mean, there was a phrase or a saying that became popular a few years back. I don't know if it's still popular, but maybe you've come across it, this idea that, you know, pics or it didn't happen, this phrase that, like, unless you can provide a visual record of an event, I don't believe your testimony. Right.
Yeah, no, exactly. And you can actually see more complicated variants on it. One of my favorite is from the television show The X-Files. I don't know if folks remember the show from the 1990s.
Yeah, you're showing your age now, unfortunately.
They rebooted it, you know.
Oh, that's true, actually. So, I forgot about it. Yeah.
And actually, and the reboot is actually really interesting to this point. So back in the 1990s, we have these FBI agents, Mulder and Scully, running around, and Mulder is always finding aliens. He's always finding extraterrestrials, but he never gets a video or a picture of them. And in the 1990s, that kind of makes sense, like, because cameras are bulky and you can't carry them everywhere with you when you're hunting bad guys. So it would make sense that he would never actually have a picture to show anybody. However, now, when they rebooted the show about 5 years ago, the obvious question was, well, come on, Mulder's got a video camera in his cell phone. Why isn't he just constantly getting videos of aliens all the time? And the show had to write into the script a moment where Mulder tries to take a picture of something and he's incapable of operating the phone properly. He's an old guy and he doesn't know how to use phones. And so they had to explain away why Fox Mulder can't ever take pictures of this phone, because otherwise, given what we know about the availability of recording technology today, Mulder would lose all credibility instantly, because he claims to be constantly encountering aliens but never getting video of them. And his answer has to be, oh, I just can't use phones ever. I'm really bad at using phone video. So that's an example of how, as the technology has become more and more available, our trust in people who are going to make extreme claims is affected by the expectation that they would have available to them some form of recording technology.
Yeah, that's a really interesting example. Like, I'm always interested when I look at old movies where a lot of the plot revolves around the fact that somebody can't get to a phone in a relevant amount of time, where this is no longer a thing. It seems to me that the screenwriter's solution to the dilemma there was probably a poor one. It would seem better to me if you said, like, somehow the aliens have a technology that blocks or prevents us from taking proper images of them or something like that. I don't know.
That's interesting. What's more plausible? An FBI agent can't figure out how to take a picture on his cell phone? Or yeah, exactly.
This has been implicit in everything you've been saying, but just to draw it out, in the paper you distinguish between two different ways in which audiovisual recordings regulate our testimonial practices. You talk about the idea of acute correction and passive regulation. Could you explain the distinction between those two things and maybe give some examples of those phenomena in action?
Sure. So acute correction is the idea that when somebody has made a claim in testimony, the presentation of an audio or video recording can immediately be used, or I shouldn't say immediately, but can be used to correct them, to say, no, you're wrong about this. And a really famous example of this in U.S. politics is the famous smoking gun tape of Richard Nixon. So Nixon, at the height of the Watergate crisis, it emerged that he had a secret recording system, an audio recording system in the White House, and he'd been recording himself talking to all of his aides, mostly without their knowledge. And when that came out, he was already being investigated. There was a huge court fight over the tapes. Eventually, after a long, long fight, he was forced to turn them over, and there emerged one particular recording from 1972 of him giving a direction through his chief of staff for the CIA to interfere with the FBI's investigation of Watergate, which he had denied doing. So there it was on the recording, direct evidence that his testimony that he hadn't done, hadn't known about any of this stuff, was a lie. He had, in fact, been involved in it from the beginning. And that once that tape came out, his support collapsed and he resigned within a few weeks. So that's a famous example of acute correction. Nixon testified to something, the people around him trusted him, or at least pretended to, and testified to his innocence. And then a recording showed that he was lying and he'd made the people around him lie on his behalf. And that undermined all of the claims they were making. So those are cases of acute correction where it's been clearly demonstrated someone was lying or speaking irresponsibly. Passive regulation, I think, is the much more common phenomenon where no one is actually presenting a recording that shows anybody speaking falsely, but it's our background awareness of that possibility that there could be a tape, that there could be a recording of some form that encourages us all to be more honest and to be more direct in how much we actually know and how sincere we're being. And so the Fox Mulder case is a complicated but interesting case of that, where it's our understanding that these days people should be able to provide recordings of weird phenomena that they regularly encounter, and that fact that he can't do that requires him to provide some other explanation for why he's not able to provide the recording. So it's that sort of thing that it's hard to provide like famous examples of this, because when it works, it doesn't become famous. People are more honest precisely because they're aware there's some possibility that the recording is out there.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are maybe some social psychology experiments which suggest that maybe not exactly a recording, but when people think they're being watched by something, they
yes.
tend to be more honest. So
that's
you
right.
could probably extrapolate from that to a more general...
That's right.
This phenomenon of passive regulation exists when we think yep. that we are under scrutiny or being observed in some sense. Now, the example you had of Nixon is interesting because of the parallels with now the modern era or today, and
absolutely,
you know, unfortunately, there's a sense in which all conversations lead to Trump. And I will ask mm-hmm. you about that in a moment. But I think mm-hmm. a first point I want to make here is just to clarify something in this argument about the role of audiovisual recordings. Now, your mm-hmm. argument doesn't assume, I guess anyway, it doesn't assume that recordings are somehow a pure window into the truth. I mean, it seems pretty obvious that the reality is more complex and that recordings are always going to be subject to some kind of interpretation and dispute. And you know, the example that sprung to mind here, in my mind, ahead anyway, was this dispute from last year, I think, when the CNN White House reporter Jim Acosta allegedly assaulted a mm-hmm. White House staffer, or it was claimed that he had assaulted a White House staffer who tried to pull a microphone away from him. Now, there was a doctored video that was produced in that case to make it look like a more violent action than it actually was. But, I mean, even if the video wasn't completely doctored, it seems to me that there is, like, an interpretive dispute. Maybe it's completely unreasonable,
yes,
but it's still in a dispute as to actually what was happening there. Was he violently pushing her away or aggressively pushing her away, or was he just doing something kind of inadvertent or almost automatic in what he was doing?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And one thing you can... Well, you can see that is that we actually don't even need the video to see the problem of interpretation. So imagine we'd all just been sitting there in the White House press briefing room and sitting a few feet away and seen that interaction. We might actually disagree about what we saw, about whether or not it was an aggressive action or whether it was just a happenstance of how he was waving his hands, gesticulating, making a point when the staffer happened to walk up to him and try to take the microphone. So even eyewitness testimony can disagree about this sort of thing. So yeah, I definitely don't want to claim that videotape has some greater epistemic superiority than eyewitness, the effects of your own eyes and ears right there in the room. It definitely is open to interpretation, and people can misperceive, people can dispute how to understand a video. That is totally true. All I want to claim is that in the absence of audio or recording, audio or video recording, all we have to go on sometimes is people's testimony, and the presence of audio or video recording allows another kind of check. It's almost as it's not perfect, but it's a little bit closer to us having been in the room and having our own way of interpreting what's going on.
Yeah, actually, it occurs to me now that I mentioned it that possibly a better example of this phenomenon is something like video referees in sports, where even when you replay what happened from multiple different angles, there can be a dispute as to whether there was a foul or whether there was a score or whatever. Sometimes, you know,
exactly
these issues still arise.
Exactly, it doesn't resolve forever. And I want to go back briefly just to the example from the Jim Acosta, the reporter at the White House, because part of that case was so interesting was that the video. It's not clear that it was doctored, apparently. People who do forensic video analysis said it might be an issue about how digital video recording is compressed. So it looked to some people like the video had been sped up to make it look like his hands were moving fast and aggressively, faster than they actually were. But it might be because of the weird way that digital video gets compressed. It actually inadvertently introduced a distortion into the movement of his hands that no one put there on purpose, but conveniently for those who wanted to make him look bad, it did in fact look like he was waving his hands faster than somebody would if they were just making a point. So even in that case, even if there was no ill intent, which I suspect there was ill intent, but even if there was no ill intent, the nature of the technology might have made it so that there was a ground of a point about which we could dispute. So I think that's a really helpful case for recognizing there are limitations to the technology even before we get into deliberate fabrication.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if this is a good example because this might have more to do with photography, which is something you discuss specifically in the paper, but there are also certain kinds of images that we know are subject to lots of processing, and so we know not to trust them in some sense. So, like, the example that I'm most familiar with here would be, like, astronomy photography. When the Hubble telescope gets these wonderful images of the Orion Nebula, that's not a perfect replication of what you would see if you look through it, if you could look through it. It's a processed and reconstructed image. A lot of the colors are added to make it more appealing to the human eye. They're not actually intrinsic to the astronomical phenomenon itself.
You know? Yeah, no, that's right. Or think about brain scan images, fMRI images, which we present to ourselves as if they were pictures. We call them images, but in fact, they don't work anything like taking pictures of the camera. They're using a kind of statistical technique measuring the presence of oxygen, and we represent it visually to make it easy for humans to consume it, but we can feel it that way. It looks like we're looking at a picture of somebody's brain, but what we're actually doing is transforming information into a different sensory medium that makes it more accessible to us.
Yeah, no, that's another good example. I mean, the epistemic value of these images is, of course, disputed by scientists who work actively in the fields. And one of the things they worry about is that creating these images paints a misleading picture of the phenomenon, that people will be misled because they're inclined to trust images.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, there's actually been a psychological study on this just showing that if you give people a fake research article and you just put an image of a brain scan in it that actually has nothing to do with the article, people find the article more trustworthy than if there's not such an image there.
Yeah, okay. So the next question then, I suppose, is maybe let's go to the Trumpian question, right? Which is that, is there a risk of overstating the importance of audiovisual recordings in social epistemology? I mean, do people really care about them? It seems that Trump is a classic case in point of somebody who doesn't really care whether an image disproves something that he said. So, you know, like, he's frequently said things that he doesn't know people. The most recent example is probably that he's never met Prince Andrew, or he doesn't know who he is, and yet people have produced multiple photographs of him talking to him and engaging with him. And there are many, many examples of this in Trump's case. Is he just like a special illustration of somebody who has such a reckless disregard for whether he is being truthful, or is he just a product of the times that we live in as well, I wonder?
That's a good question. I mean, I think part of it is a distinctive feature of Trump where, he came out of New York real estate development in the 1980s, where it was understood in that world that you're not telling the truth all the time. Hopefully, if you're doing a deal with somebody, you're telling partial truths, but you're certainly going to be puffing up what you're doing. You're going to be exaggerating. And so I don't think Donald Trump has ever been, I don't think anybody thinks, even I think a lot of his supporters understand that a lot of what he's doing isn't true literally, but they just want it to be true thematically in some way. So he's a weird special case that I wouldn't consider his relative political stability to be a counterexample to the general point, because it is still true that most other politicians can be badly embarrassed by being caught out. And even Trump, to small extents, is reactive to this stuff. Like, you gave the example of how he says he hasn't met somebody, then a photo emerges. This has happened over and over and over again, like pretty reliably. Whenever anything bad happens, Donald Trump says, "I never met that person." Then a week later, there's a bunch of photos of him meeting the person. And so he has started preempting that. I think, I forgot who it was at this point. I think it might have been Rudy Giuliani's less savory associates. When they got in trouble, Donald Trump said, I don't know these people. I've never met them. But if there's a picture of me with them, that's because I take pictures of everybody. So he anticipated the role that a picture would play in putting a check on his testimony. And he tried to preempt the evidential effect of that. So even he's at least sort of responsive to this, but he's certainly an unusual case.
Now, let's summarize the argument to this point. It's that audiovisual recordings have, for the past century and a half, I guess, or century mm-hmm. and a half for video recordings, and century and a half for, let's say, photography or something like that as well, have played this important role in social epistemology mm-hmm. by providing a check, either an active check or a passive check on our testimonial practices. Does this imply then, because your argument is that deepfakes disrupt this function of audiovisual recordings, but doesn't this imply that there was kind of a golden age when it comes to the epistemic value of audiovisual recordings? Mm-hmm. In a sense, I guess, like particularly the latter half of the 20th century into the early part of the 21st century, when audiovisual recordings were so socially significant when it came to our testimonial practices, but that golden age has now passed or is in danger of passing more quickly than we may have appreciated.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question. So let me, if your listeners complete the last bits of the argument, I think we've already hinted at most of it, but I just want to pull it together to make sure everybody's got a full handle on it and then address the question you just asked. So my worry with deepfakes is that once there's been a famous incident, once everyone attends to a big controversial case where some video has appeared and some people are saying that was faked and others are saying, no, it was a real video and it's a political point at the center of some election. When that happens, then a whole lot of people are going to come away from that saying, wait a minute, if this is a possibility, if these things could be faked, then how can I rely upon other videos, other audio recordings, even legitimate ones? And so my worry is that we have a greater degree of skepticism, generalized skepticism about audio and video recordings across all forms of public discourse in a way that erodes their backstop functions, that they are less able to be acutely corrective or passively regulating our epistemic practices. So that's the fundamental worry of the paper. And so what you asked about just now is whether we can conceive the last century or so when these recordings were relatively reliable as a kind of golden age. And I think there's one way in which that's right for the reasons you described. We had this greater backing to our epistemic practices. There is a flip side to that, which other people have encouraged me to attend to, which is that we have become more easily manipulable because, for example, for reasons we already discussed, once you see a video or a picture or an audio recording, you're more likely to believe the thing that's being testified to. So if someone, a very sophisticated person, is able to create a fake audio recording, and I say very sophisticated because in the past, this was very hard to do. Before deepfakes, it was very hard to do. It was very expensive. It required a lot of skill. But if you could create believable fake pictures and audio recordings, then you could trick people very effectively, precisely because the technology was relatively reliable. So we were the 20th century was in many ways a kind of double-edged, epistemically double-edged time of recordings, because they were good, because they provided us this backstop to our ordinary testimonial practices, but they also made us vulnerable in particular ways due to how trustworthy they seemed to be, and it was still at least possible with a lot of money and time to fake them. So the question now is, if I'm right that deepfakes are going to erode this role of audio and video recordings, what happens to us next? Do we just go back to the way things were with testimony before in the 19th century, 18th century, all of human history before recordings, or does something else happen? And my worry now is that it's not that we can just easily go back. It's sort of like when you become reliant on a technology, like people are now reliant on their phones for map navigation, Google Maps or GPS. People don't really carry around paper maps with them anymore. And some people, I think, don't really know how to use paper maps very effectively. I'm not that great at them. And I think younger people probably have no idea how to use paper maps to travel, to figure out long distance travel, because they expect GPS and Google Maps to be reliable. And it's the same thought. Everyone who's alive today in developed countries has lived their entire lives in an epistemic environment structured by reliance on recordings. If we can no longer rely on that very suddenly, in a space of 5 years or 10 years, I'm not sure we have in place the kind of epistemic practices that our ancestors had to help them navigate epistemic environments before recordings. That's the big worry I have. It's not necessarily that things were better in the 20th century than in the 19th or 18th, but they were different. And if we very suddenly shift back to 19th century reliability without the kind of protective norms that people developed back then, that's what I'm afraid of, is how we handle the sudden transition back to a less reliable environment.
Yeah, that's interesting, because it's essentially like any other kind of technological dependency argument here, which is that we have become epistemically dependent on audiovisual recordings. And if that dependency is undermined, do we have the epistemic resilience to deal with the new world that is created as a result? And I think you're definitely right that we can't go back to the way it was. I might say that for a stronger reason than you would say, which is that I think there was something worse about the past when it came to social epistemology. There was maybe more reliance on authorities.
Yeah.
Right. Is this something you've thought about, that, and I think other people have made this argument, that the rise of deepfakes, one of the things it's going to do because it's going to mean that, well, we can't just trust the raw image or video itself anymore. We have to look at its provenance, where it came from.
Absolutely.
And so this has two functions, actually, just for me to complete the thought, which is that one is that we'll care more about the source of it. Does it come from an authoritative source that we are inclined to trust? But also there's another aspect of this as well, which is that we'll need to rely more on experts to tell us whether it is fake or not, and whether we can decode it. This seems to be a bad thing, because one of the great functions of audiovisual recordings is that they were a leveler, in a sense. And you see this in, let's say, the Black Lives Matter movements or something like this, that recording what the police do, let's say, is a way of speaking truth to power. But if recordings lose their epistemic value, you can't trust them intrinsically, that gets undermined, right?
Yes, no, that's absolutely right. And one way we can understand that distinction, or that worry, is by building on a distinction made by other philosophers. The philosopher Dan Cavedon-Taylor has, I think, a very helpful paper about the epistemology of photography. You think about still images here, but the basic idea, I think, carries through to audio and video recordings. And the thought is this, that we can distinguish between two different types of epistemic justification. One we can call perceptual, which is the kind of justification I get from seeing and hearing something myself. And the other, we've already been talking about, is testimonial. Somebody else tells me what they saw or heard. And the claim is that we want to ask, what kind of justification is information you get from a photograph? And one claim we might make is that historically, the function it served is closer to perceptual than testimonial. In other words, a photograph gets you an image of what it would have looked like if you had been standing in the position where the camera is, more or less. Absent somebody tinkering with the camera, which of course is a possibility, and an increasingly urgent possibility, but absent that, you get what it actually would have looked like for you, which distinguishes that from like a painting, where a painting is very much dependent upon the artist's perspective and their reliability. The mechanism that captures the thing that's being depicted goes through another person in the painting case or in verbal testimony, whereas for pictures, it goes via the mechanism, which is closer to an approximation of your own perceptual faculties. And so that's part of Cavedon-Taylor's point, is to say that photographs have had this function much closer to perception than testimony. The worry, and he starts hinting at that in the paper, although it's not his main point, is that with digital manipulation of photographs, and I extend this to audio and video recordings, that perceptual, that quasi-perceptual role of recordings has been eroded to the point where we should increasingly think of recordings as more like just a different type of testimony. They're no more reliable than somebody say-so, or somebody's making a painting, or somebody's doing a mimicry, et cetera, et cetera. It's running through a kind of agency, a person who has control over how you get the information. And once that happens, this is bringing us back to the point you were just raising, authority really matters, track record really matters, what you think of the person you're talking to really matters. You need to think about the recording less as a kind of independent check, a speaking truth to power, or a kind of standing outside of a dispute. It functions less like this kind of perceptual knowledge you'd get if you'd been there yourself, and more like just another story somebody's telling you, only as reliable as the person who's telling it to you. And so, like you said, we're back to, we've moved back back to a point where we can only rely upon recordings if we trust the people who are giving them to us, if we trust they came from an originator who is somebody who is an authority or at least a trustworthy person. And if we don't know where they came from, if they just appear on the internet, on YouTube, we ought to be suspicious because it's just like a rumor being passed around. So I agree with you that this is eroding the way in which recordings could function as a kind of independent check on existing authority figures.
Right. And I mean, again, to bring this around to Trump once more, in an era of greater political partisanship, which I know is one of your other interest, this seems to be a recipe for disaster, right?
Absolutely, yeah. So I assume the first time there is some sort of what I call in the paper a deepfake crisis or backstop crisis, where there is an instance of a deepfake and we're all fighting whether it's real or not, it seems very likely the fight will break down on partisan lines. So if the recording makes a politician you like look bad, you're going to say it's a deep fake. And if you don't like the politician, of course, you're going to say it's a real recording. And it's very likely that that's how we're going to fracture. And so, of course, everybody, the horrible thing about these kind of partisan fights is people are more closely connected to their identity as a partisan than they are to identities as a gatherer of knowledge, an independent gatherer of knowledge. And so people are going to revise their epistemic standards, what kind of proof you're willing to accept, in order to allow them to hang on to the partisan perspective they want to have. So we're going to be watching in real time as people are publicly disputing the criteria for what counts as a reliable video recording. And it's very obvious to everybody they're just saying whatever allows them to say what they want to say about the particular thing we're disputing right now. And that would further erode our trust in these things, because again, it now looks like they're not a kind of independent check on what's happening. They're just another tool that partisans use to try to advance their own perspective. And that's, I think these mechanisms, the unreliability of the recordings themselves, or the new unreliability with deepfakes, and partisan motivation to change your epistemic standards to help your side, those two are going to reinforce each other. And I that's what makes me think this is going to happen very fast once it starts to happen.
Right. I mean, so the causes of political partisanship are multifold, but this seems like the ideal catalyst for enhanced political partisanship. I don't know, have you read Neal Stephenson's most recent novel, The Fall? Have you come across this?
No, I haven't. Okay. I haven't.
So in the first couple of hundred pages of that, it's not a deep fake crisis, but it's a faked nuclear attack, essentially. This is a spoiler, sorry, for people who are reading it, but it then traces out the consequences of this for greater political partisanship, and the United States basically bifurcates into two completely different worlds between the coasts and the bit in between, in a sense. Anyway, for people who are interested in this phenomenon, I think it's an interesting read.
There is a real world case of this. It's a bit unclear exactly what happened, but in Gabon, about a year ago, the president, Ali Bongo, disappeared. He'd had a stroke, apparently, and he left the country to seek medical treatment. And he'd been gone for a few months. I think he had the stroke in the autumn of 2018. And around the new year, he released a videotape wishing a happy new year to the people of Gabon. And the video was very strange. And so his political opponents, some of them, told the press that it was a deep fake, that he was actually dead, that he died from the stroke months ago, and that the military had used deepfake technology to create a fake video appearing to show him still alive at the new year so they could preserve military rule. This is one of several different disputes. This is what's a bit unclear from outside. I don't know how true this is, but there was an attempted coup which failed. People died. There was military fighting. And part of what was going on in that tussle was dispute over whether or not the video was a deepfake. Now, it turned out months later, he was alive. He came back. And it looks like the video was not a deepfake. It looked weird because he had a stroke and his face was paralyzed. And so his face wasn't moving in the way you'd expect it to, but that actually was for medical reasons, not for video reasons. But at the time, that was not universally agreed upon because no one had seen him in months. So there's a real world example where the dispute of whether or not we could trust the video is used in a partisan political fight between the government and between its opponents. And in this case, led to people dying. It led to an attempted coup, or played a part in an attempted coup, I should say. There were other factors. So that's the kind of thing that I worry about. That on a bigger scale, that in a place where in a large raucous democracy like the United States or the UK, where partisan divides are getting worse and worse over time, could lead to a kind of fracturing. It may not go quite to the point of revolution or coup, but it could go to the point of really, really entrenching animosities between partisan sides, where it's just not possible anymore to have honest disagreements across politics.
I don't know if you've thought about this, but is this a more of a problem in countries that have kind of two-party systems, or is it a problem in all countries, even more kind of multi-party states?
That's a good question. So for deepfakes, I don't know if it matters how many parties. For partisanship, I think having two parties almost certainly makes things worse because you have fewer options. It's very much about polarity. Literally, there are two poles, and you can pick one or the other. And the more people fracture along a partisan divide, the more outrageous and disloyal it can seem to people to defect from one side to the other. In a multi-party system where, you know, so there's four or five choices and there's kind of gradations in ideology between some of the parties, moving back and forth between one party and another, as long as they're not polar opposites, is less, depending on the circumstance, is less shocking. It's less outrageous, especially if you have strategic voters who switches, say, in the UK, if you might switch between Labour and the Lib Dems in particular elections, or perhaps between the Conservatives and the Lib Dems, you might do that strategically, and people might understand that. In a two-party system like in the US, it's really increasingly rare for people to be public about the fact that they switch back and forth between the two parties, precisely because the divide seems so stark.
So, I mean, we've been focusing on deepfakes here, but this is there's a bigger problem here with the role of technology in politics. And I just want to put this question to you. Like, do you think that technology is basically eroding the sense of a shared public space of reasons? I don't know.
Yeah, I do. I definitely have this worry. So I'm working on a book right now about social media and democracy. And that the fundamental claim of the book is that for democracy to function, we have to have a certain set of moral relations to one another, a certain set of norms about seeing each other as legitimately disagreeing and legitimately having differing opinions and legitimately having a claim on how we make decisions together, even if we can't ultimately agree on the right way to live our lives. And I don't think democracy works without some amount of adherence to those norms. And my worry is that technology, especially social media, is eroding some of those norms by giving us reasons to think that people are less trustworthy than we used to, because we see them spreading around disinformation like fake news or deepfakes, being complicit in deception campaigns, perhaps orchestrated by foreign governments. And seeing that gives us reason to think less and less that we are together all members of a trustworthy community. So that is my big worry, is that this technology, it's doing lots of things, other bad things as well. But for my purposes, thinking about the sustainability of democratic projects and effective disagreement, that's the big worry here, is the technology is being harnessed to discourage people from thinking about each other in this respectful way.
Right. I mean, so it seems to me that this is a point that lots of people have made, which is that, you know, democracies thrive on a sense that we're all playing the same game by a shared set of rules, which are often tacit, not necessarily mm-hmm. written or explicit. And this seems to undermine that. It becomes a form of civil war, in a sense, that you bifurcate into different political teams and you don't share the same game or the same reality anymore.
Right. Yeah, that's right. But I think that's all of that's true. But I want to go one step further than that, which is that we start to see individual people, and this is why social media is so dangerous, being complicit in that erosion of a common reality. So in the Soviet Union, people did not tend to trust propaganda from the state. You didn't necessarily have information you could rely upon. People were sometimes just unclear what was happening in the world or even in their own town. But you tended to think that most of the people you knew most of the time weren't really actively playing a role. You were kind of in it together as being victims of being hoodwinked by the regime. The difference, and I picked the Soviet Union, but that's true of many totalitarian states, the difference of what's happening now with deceptive content on social media is that your fellow citizens are among the people who are responsible for tricking you or tricking each other. They're the ones who are choosing to share fake news or to spread a deep fake by directing people to the YouTube video. And so there's a way in which we all become complicit in the erosion of a common reality and of democratic reliability. And I think that's importantly different than old-fashioned propaganda or state-sponsored deception.
Yeah, I think that's right in the case of propaganda and misinformation. I may have a little bit of a pushback insofar as, you know, there was a lack of trust of neighbors and people that you lived around as well.
Sure.
In communist states.
Oh, sure. East Germany, for example, for sure. I don't want to say it was a, you know, paradise of solidarity against the state in all cases, but just that people were not. The default assumption was not that everybody around you is constantly actively disseminating misinformation.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Maybe a couple of kind of wrapping up questions here to bring it back around to deepfakes. You know, the assumption here in the argument is that there is something particularly disruptive about deepfakes. Maybe we could just probe that in a little bit more depth, because it seems that this is a problem that comes from lots of types of fakery or trickery with others, with any trusted source of information. Okay. Mm-hmm. Is there something distinctive about the threat posed by deepfakes? Is it just because we're so reliant on audiovisual recordings, or that they can be spread so quickly, as you mentioned earlier, that you can do this kind of real-time deepfakes? Is there something different, or is this more of the same old phenomena that we had?
Yeah, so to some extent, there's similar things going on with old-fashioned trickery. I mean, to continue the Soviet example, infamously, Stalin had a group of people whose job it was to manipulate photographs, eliminating depictions of former Soviet officials who he'd eliminated from life. After they were gone, they had to be eliminated from the historical record. So we know there is manipulation, but I think there's at least two important differences of what's happening now from historical manipulation of records. So one is that I think audio and video recordings themselves are a kind of backstop to other forms of recordings. And you can see this often when a still photograph is disputed and people are like, well, that could be Photoshopped, or they say, well, that could just be a weird angle. People say, okay, is there a video? Can we find a video that shows the preceding seconds before this, the seconds around it? If we can find a video that is consistent with what the still image shows, that provides more trust in the still image. And part of the reason we do that is because we so far assume it's much harder to fake a video. It's much more expensive and difficult to fake an entire long video over 10, 15 seconds than to fake a single still image. And so there's this way that even as the reliability of photography has been eroded by Photoshop, the background assumption that we could find video to, or we could demand video as a kind of backstop to photography, that is now what's going away. And so my worry is that there's no backstop to the backstop, that we don't currently have any technology that has been more reliable than video and audio recordings that could be our next step back as that technology is eroded. So that's one big worry, that in the at least over the last century, as photography has been eroded as a testimonial source, as a quasi-perceptual source, we had this other technology to step in on its behalf. So that's one set of worries. We're losing the final backstop. The other worry has to do with the particular AI feature, machine learning. It's a kind of a simple form of AI, machine learning feature of deepfakes, which is that they're incredibly responsive and quick and generative. And what I mean by that is if somebody issues a challenge about one video, that someone says, you know, well, there's a video that seems to be showing this politician doing something, but who knows if that video is reliable? And, you know, that was a public occasion. There surely must have been another camera there. We need to find out whether there's another video showing from a different angle the same thing. Well, a liar could respond to that overnight, generate a new deepfake from a different angle if they use some other existing footage and plaster different faces on top of it. From that, they could, in real time, or at least overnight, create a video that responds to that challenge. And that was not true of historical record alteration. Historically, you couldn't just create a convincing set of faked photographs overnight, even if you were really, really good at it. It took time, it took money, it took expertise. But as this technology gets better, we'll get to a point where being able to answer that kind of challenge, reasonable, authority demonstrating challenge, that can be done by the technology very, very quickly and very effectively. And so that will erode our existing defenses against misleading images, misleading recordings, because this standard technique of saying, well, show me another angle, show me another video, it starts being pointless. Of course, I can show you another video, even if it's not real. And that's a big worry. And I think that's new, and that's enabled by the specific machine learning capacity.
So is there anything we can do to stop this? I mean, can laws help to arrest this erosion of the public space? I don't know if you have any thoughts on the Californian legislation that was recently passed.
Yeah, I think the California case is a really good example because there are actually two laws there. One having to do with political deepfakes, which banned the use of deceptive recording within 60 days of an election, deceptive recording, manipulated recording showing politicians. That was one law. The other law allowed for legal action against people who spread deepfake pornography. And I think the second law is a much more sensible law, much more likely to, I don't know if it'll work. I don't know, yet how effective it'll be in deterring people who are making deepfake porn in other parts of the world under to worry about California law, but at least it's really defensible. The intentions are basically this is a form of involuntary pornography, and people have a right to not be put into pornography against their consent. I don't think there's any free speech defense for forcing people to appear in porn against their consent. So those laws look pretty solid. I don't know if they'll work or not, but at least they seem in principle to be well conceived. The first set of laws about political deepfakes are much harder. I doubt those will survive under U.S. First Amendment scrutiny. The U.S. has very strong protections for political speech of any form, and so I mean, I'm sure that I'm not a lawyer, so I'm sure U.S. constitutional lawyers will work on this for many years. But it's less clear. The really important thing here is the law has an exemption for parody or satire, and no one knows how exactly to define parody or satire here. Most people who produce political fake videos, like maybe people remember about 6 months ago, there was a doctored video of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi where she appeared to be drunk. She was slurring her words, and it emerged that it wasn't even a deep fake. It was a very, very simple fake. It was just that the audio was slowed down to make her voice and make her voice sound strange. So it was pretty obvious. This has been done if you were paying attention. It wasn't sophisticated. And yet, the claim that was made by the people who produced it was that it was a parody. It wasn't meant to actually trick anybody. It was just meant to make fun of Nancy Pelosi. And yet, people did fall for it. So that's the worry here. This kind of law is going to run right into that. Enforcing it, interpreting is going to be very hard because everybody who is trying to trick people is just going to claim it was parody under the parody exception.
Yeah, no, I think that's right when it comes to the political uses of deepfakes. I can't see how that law is going to be workable in practice. I mean, partly of that is because, as you say, people who do create these things and are willing to own up to the fact that they create it will say that they've created it for satirical purposes, or it's all part of the reasonable exchange of political opinion or argumentation in some sense. But also, I presume there's going to be lots of people who create these things who are untraceable or don't
That's right.
not
That's
located
right.
in the jurisdiction. So if Russia
That's
is
right.
intervening in the U.S. election, they don't really care what the law in California is saying.
Yep,
And
that's right.
I think the problem with this as well is that it gives you a cause of action against somebody for putting these videos or sharing these videos or producing them. But the damage could be done, politically speaking,
Absolutely.
before you manage to shut it down, you know?
Yeah, and I also think in the political context, I'm less worried about the damage of a convincing deepfake. I actually think it's really important to flag this point because I think a lot of the public discussion I think is it misses the in my opinion, misses the point here. The danger in politics is not so much that any particular video gets believed, but that the debate about whether we can believe them erodes the general reliability of videos. And so, in other words, the harm being done isn't really to a particular politician. It's not to Nancy Pelosi or Donald Trump. It's to all of us collectively. And so it doesn't really even matter that much if you successfully prosecute or sue or do anything to a particular creator. The harm is done generally after this has happened a few times, especially if, like you say, it's untraceable who created it. So as far as like stopping the problem I'm worried about, I'm not even sure this legislation could address that. I do think the legal domain is probably the wrong way of addressing this. I think the real responsibility here is on the internet companies. It's on the social media platforms. It's on YouTube. It's on anybody who plays host to online videotapes and distributes it, online video recordings. And I have a particular proposal, I think, for how they ought to manage this. I think they ought to require that any manipulated video or audio be flagged as such. So, in other words, when you go to upload a recording, if you manipulate it in any way, you have to tick a little box that says, I manipulated this. And anybody who gets caught uploading anything manipulated without ticking that box, automatically gets taken down. Doesn't matter if it was political, doesn't matter if it was satirical, doesn't matter what the point is. If you didn't tick the box that admitted you manipulated it, then you lied about not manipulating it, and therefore it should be taken down as a form of deception. And I think this is really helpful. One other side of this puzzle, sorry, I forgot one part of it. The things that do get ticked with the box being manipulated should be displayed in some distinctive way, like a border around them that is a weird color. I don't know. I'm sure someone who's an expert in internet design will have a better proposal than I do, but something that's very clear to users that tells them immediately and visually the thing they're looking at was manipulated in some way. And I think if we had that system in place, it wouldn't be perfect, but it would at least cut down on the ways in which people can hide behind the claim, oh, it was meant to be parody, I wasn't really trying to trick people. If they didn't click the box and said it was manipulated, then that shows that they in fact were trying to trick people, or they weren't at least being responsible about warning people that it was a joke. So I think that is the minimum thing we can do. I think that would cut down on a lot of this stuff. I wish that the social media firms could do that. They could implement it right now. I'm not sure exactly what the motive is to not do it.
I'd love to maybe go back and forth on that in more detail, but I think unfortunately we're out of time, so that's maybe a good place to leave it with an interesting proposal to how to address this problem and maybe a chink of light for the future, a little bit of hope as to the future of our politics. So thank you for joining me for this conversation today, Regina.
Sure, of course. It was a lot of fun. Thank you very much for the questions.